Okay, tape's rolling. Anytime you want.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
This is Vincent Price. Michael Jackson is...
The Thriller. Do we both say it?
Say it together? I say inviting you to? All right, yeah.
Okay.
Anytime, test roll.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
And this is Vincent Price inviting you to...
The Thriller.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Wondering what I'm doing carrying around a stepladder. Well, let me assure you, I was hanging pictures and not people. But there may be some others of you who know that I have another interest besides movies, and that's an interest in fine arts.
Today we're talking about legendary actor, narrator, gourmet cook, and art lover Vincent Price. Yes, that Vincent Price. We'll mostly be focusing on that last part, his lifelong passion for art, but we couldn't have a Halloween episode without a little touch of the macabre. Our guest is Christina Burke, Philbrook's curator of Native American and non-Western art. We'll get to what all that means in a little bit, but she's also quite possibly our resident expert on horror and B-movies. All right, here we go. It was a dark and stormy night. We're going to talk about Vincent Price.
Okay.
So, Vincent Price, I remember when I started working at the museum about 8 years ago, a few years into that, we had our 75th anniversary at the museum, and there was this massive timeline that we put up to show all the different things that had happened at the museum over the years. And one of those images that I saw on this timeline, that was kind of an illustrated timeline, was a picture of Vincent Price at Philbrook looking at some pottery, and he had some people with him. And that was the first time that I think I had heard about Vincent Price coming to Philbrook, coming to Tulsa. And having been a fan of his for a long time, especially I think Edward Scissorhands was my first, which is kind of interesting. That was his last film, but it was my first introduction to him. And I think I went back. But when did you first become aware of Vincent Price and his relation to the museum and Tulsa? Or maybe it goes back further than that.
Well, I knew that he was an art collector in general and was also a big supporter of Native American art specifically. He had served on the Indian Arts and Crafts Board from 1957 to 71, I believe, were the dates.
Was he courted for that?
He was courted for that, is my understanding, yes. He was already an art collector. And he was not a big collector of Native American art, but he was a supporter of contemporary Native artists. I think that's an important distinction.
It's kind of a funny idea thinking about the concept of celebrity art advocates, because it's not something that we have a lot of today. And maybe it's something that we've never really had much of in terms of people going out into the public sphere and using their platform, especially, say, actors or anyone, to really advocate for fine art. You see sometimes, like, Beyonce and Jay-Z, you know, they'll go to the Met or something, or they'll go stand in front of the Louvre. And there are moments like that, but not in terms of the level that he did. I mean, he took it beyond that. He would lecture and do tours about art. Do you think that was something that he felt was a more than just a hobby, more than a passion?
More than just a hobby, yes. And actually, I think Steve Martin is a good example today of big-time contemporary art collector who also lectures on the subject, et cetera, and I think uses his celebrity to help advocate for contemporary art.
If I'm not mistaken, Steve Martin actually curated an exhibition at LACMA a couple
that
of years ago, which was kind of an interesting moment. You know, you being a curator, to get to this place where you are, you've spent decades, you know, in scholarship and looking at all these different areas of expertise that you have. And this is the idea of someone who is not necessarily from academia or anywhere kind of jumping into that sphere. Is that something that makes you nervous when someone just says, well, I'm going to curate a show, but I'm not really a curator? Or do you kind of say the more voices, the better?
Yeah. I think the more voices, the better, and especially if those voices are knowledgeable. And there's all different kinds of knowledge. Some of it does come from academia, but there are very knowledgeable collectors as well. And in my area, Native American art, my background, my academic background, is actually in anthropology, not in art history. There are not many art history programs that focus on Native American art, so a lot of us come from other academic disciplines. And I'm also not Native, and there are certainly very knowledgeable Native voices that should be included in curation, in publications, in research, in programs, et cetera. So I have no problem with a non-academic being a curator, as long as they're knowledgeable about the subject.
Well, that's a good point, because as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, Vincent Price wasn't Native either.
Not as far as I know.
But he took on this important role. Kind of explain go a little bit into, you know, what his role was leading that organization from, you said, 57 to, what did you say?
71, I believe.
Yeah. So a pretty long time to do that. Was he going out and kind of basically selling the idea of people opening their minds up more to Native art and bigger institutions? You know, what was the function he was serving other than just a celebrity voice?
Well, the Indian Arts and Crafts Board was established in 1935 and was part of what's known as the Indian New Deal, so economic support specifically for Native people. And he joined in 57, I think I said, and was one of several commissioners. So he didn't lead it until later in his tenure. But the purpose of the Indian Arts and Crafts Board is to support Native arts. And that means both supporting the artists with opportunities for workshops, classes, materials, and outlets to sell their work, but also helping to inform the public about what Native art is and why they should buy it and where they should get the real deal. So in his role as one of the commissioners on the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, he lectured. He attended all kinds of Native art events, shows. For instance, in 1957, one of his first official functions was to attend the annual Gallup Intertribal Ceremonial in northern New Mexico, which is an art show, a rodeo, kind of an exposition of Southwestern Native cultures.
Is it still ongoing?
It's ongoing.
You
bet. Started in 1920s. I have never been.
You've never been. You go to New Mexico all the time.
I do. I usually attend the other big event in New Mexico, which is the annual Santa Fe Indian Market, which began in 1922.
So Vincent Price, he got a degree in art history from Yale. He also was very interested in gourmet cooking. He wrote cookbooks. Of course, he did acting. He did radio early on. He was, you know, on The Shadow and all these different famous radio programs. He kind of did a lot of different things. And I think interesting people have many interests. But when he was coming to Philbrook and to Gilcrease, our other great museum here in town, this was such a fertile time for us and a national stage for what Philbrook was doing in relation to the what was known as the Indian Annual. Tell me a little bit about what that was and where we were in the broader sphere of Native art at that time.
Well, back in the day, Philbrook started a juried competition for Native painting called the Indian Annual, as you mentioned. It began in 1946, and it was an interesting time in Native art for all kinds of reasons, one of which is that painting in particular was changing very quickly, and not a lot of museums were collecting contemporary paintings. And this show was very different than other juried competitions like the Market in Santa Fe, for instance. The Market in Santa Fe and other juried competitions of Native art are outdoor weekend festivals. And what the Philbrook Indian Annual did was to sort of elevate and focus on painting specifically. It was not just one weekend. It was an entire month. It was an exhibition in the museum galleries. So it wasn't outdoors.
So we would clean out everything. Everything got put away.
Exactly.
And then this replaced the art that was on the walls.
That's right.
Pretty massive undertaking.
A massive undertaking, which is one of the reasons it doesn't happen anymore. It's a huge undertaking. But the other thing that really distinguished that show from others, along with the fact that it was a museum exhibition, it focused exclusively on paintings, is that there were often Native artists as the jurors, not just non-Native people. So whoever had won the competition the year before would be brought back as a juror. So it was a peer-to-peer critique, as well as scholars, curators, et cetera, who were who may or may not have been Native.
So there's this great moment in the history of the Indian Annual where the concept of abstract art gets challenged by an artist named Oscar Howe through a rejection of sorts, and a letter is written.
And it actually relates to Vincent Price, too. I didn't know if you knew that or not.
No.
But,
everything goes back to Vincent today.
Yanktonai Dakota painter named Oscar Howe from Crow Creek Reservation entered the second year of the Indian Annual, 1947, and won the Grand Award, or the Best of Show that year, and kept entering. He also attended graduate school at OU, actually earned an MFA from the University of Oklahoma, and started doing more abstract style of painting in the mid-1950s, and entered paintings and got awards, and paintings were purchased by Philbrook in this new, very contemporary style. In 1958, he entered a piece called Umini Wachipi, or War and Peace Dance, and the judges that year, not Philbrook, but the judges brought in, rejected it as being not Indian enough and too contemporary. And Oscar Howe had been showing this kind of work, winning awards, getting purchase awards from museums for 4 years up to this point. So he was really angry. Not only was this something he'd been working on and pursuing and been gaining recognition for it, but he felt like no institution and no one individual should be telling him, as a Dakota person, what Native art was. So he wrote this scathing letter back to one of my predecessors, Jeannie Snodgrass, who was at the time curator at Philbrook, and said, you know, who are you or Philbrook or the Indian Annual or the judges to define what Native art is? We Native artists will define what it is, and my work is Native. And the next year, Philbrook responded by adding a new category for contemporary paintings. And in 1959, so the year after the controversy, Oscar Howe won the Best of Show, and his piece was purchased, I believe, by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But the finer point, I think, from Oscar Howe's perspective, this new abstract contemporary style, he was also saying that was Native. So a lot of people term it Cubism and talk about the influence of non-Native painters, like, say, Picasso, on Oscar Howe and other Native painters who were creating more contemporary works. But Howe rejected that Cubism definition as well, and said, if you look at the history of, particularly on the plains, of this abstraction that we see painted onto everyday objects like parfleches, rawhide containers used for luggage, et cetera, if you look at beadwork patterns, if you look at how everyday things like clothing, moccasins, lodges, teepees were decorated, you see abstraction going back thousands of years. So he was saying that it's Native art because I'm a Native and I made it. And he was saying the kind of art, the content and the style was also distinctively Native.
So that's happening at the exact moment where there's this, you know, abstract expressionism is the biggest thing in art world, in the broader art world at that time. You have this huge conversation happening, I think not just there, but what is art? You know, is Jackson Pollock art? Is Willem de Kooning art? All these conversations happening, and that's probably been an ongoing conversation for so long. We still hear those conversations happening today as to, is it art or is it not? I think that will never probably die in terms of the art world. But I found this great clip of Vincent Price, going back to Vincent, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 1975. And he's talking about, I think he was there for a cooking segment to talk about his new cookbook. As I said, he was quite a gourmet cook. But in this conversation, it's happening, you have to realize this was the most popular show in America at that time, probably the most watched hour in the evening. And Vincent Price is on there, and Johnny Carson asks him about abstract art. And he basically says, can you help me understand this better? And they have this great back and forth. And you go, it's hard to imagine in 2017 watching a late night show and hearing a really in-depth, thoughtful discussion about the value of modern art, specifically abstract art, and how to look at it, you know? And it was kind of neat to see who Vincent Price, who was, you know, getting older at that time, still saying, I go out and I travel the country, I look for new artists, I'm always out there looking and seeing what's interesting. So
I'm gonna have to look up that clip.
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating thing. But his daughter is still living, and you've interacted with her some as well, Victoria Price.
Mm-hmm.
And has she carried on any of her father's kind of advocacy for the arts in any way?
She has. For a while, she co-owned a gallery in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then had her own gallery in Santa Fe as well, featuring mostly contemporary Native art, some historical pieces as well, but also very contemporary design. Furniture and deck arts design from places like Italy and Scandinavia. So really contemporary works.
One of the things I've loved working with you over the years is you have this great way of having an immense knowledge of certain things, even if they're campy things. You know so much about some funny B-movies. You love kind of silly things like that. And I love this dichotomy between this kind of high and low culture, whatever we want to call it. And
I take that as a compliment,
yeah,
Jeff.
Total compliment. And I always love talking with you about films and movies and all movies of all kinds. We were talking about how it would be so difficult to name our favorite movie, but when you start breaking it down, it gets a little bit easier. And we were talking about our favorite Vincent Price movie. I would have to say, like I said, Edward Scissorhands, where he plays the guy who creates Edward Scissorhands, was my first exposure to him. And I was probably 10 or 11 when that movie came out. But it was his last film. And then I went back and saw House of Wax, and I saw all these, you know, all these great films. But when I asked you, you knew right off the bat, there was no hesitation. So what is your favorite Vincent Price film?
My favorite Vincent Price film is Theater of Blood.
Okay.
So in it, Vincent Price plays a stage actor, so something close to his heart. And he's in this performance that gets panned by all of these critics. I mean, they just rip him apart. And so in the movie, he fakes his own death and then comes back to murder each and every critic in a horrible and very specific kind of way, to basically torture them.
Social commentary, an actor's dream, getting revenge on the critic.
The ultimate revenge on the critic, you bet.
When you think back to the films that scared you to death, basically, as a kid, what are those ones that left an imprint where you may have been a little too young to watch it? It kept you up at night. You're scared, laying in bed, having nightmares.
Well, number one, no doubt, is Hitchcock's Psycho. And I saw it way too young, with my mom, in fact.
A shared bonding experience.
A bonding experience. But that movie really, it's not only scary. Actually, everything about it, I think, is great. The acting, the writing, the directing.
That's amazing looking.
The music, visual.
The music is amazing.
It is really a piece of art that I come back to again and again. It's really spectacular. So
there's
that's
even
definitely
art.
One.
That's funny that you mentioned that. I just was just thinking about this. The museum actually had a piece called 24-Hour Psycho years back, which was part of a show called Cut.
Oh, yes. And that was before my time.
Yeah, it was by an artist named Christian Marclay, who's been known to do most recently a piece called The Clock, which is probably one of the most talked about pieces in the art world of the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. But what this was is it took the shower scene and it slowed it down to where it took 24 full hours to process through. So it was almost like a frame by frame, you know, and we had the screen and the gallery, and you know, it was just this amazing. But each frame of that truly is like almost like a still photograph, the composition of it, and seeing it in that way, you know, the idea that someone could take a piece of art like Hitchcock's Psycho and kind of do something with it, I think only reinforces how artful it was to begin with. So I would say The Shining is for me kind of up there.
The Shining is also another touchstone. And again, I think Kubrick, you know, really was an artist, an auteur,
yeah.
Because he took such care with every aspect, detail of that film. And I think that both Hitchcock and Kubrick use soundtrack to great effect in their movies.
Do you find that as a curator, when you tell people you're a curator or you know, you worked at the Smithsonian, for example. You've had a really long and distinguished career. Do you think people think you only like certain kinds of stuff? Would they be surprised to know that you like schlocky B-movies and that you like just silly things? Do you find that the title of curator carries anything with it that's a misnomer of any kind?
Sometimes, yes. But being a curator of Native American art gives me a little more leeway than perhaps, say, a curator of European art.
You're also a curator of non-Western art, and that's a pretty broad topic. So what exactly does that mean? You're the curator of everything else, basically?
So my responsibilities include our Native American collection, which is incredibly large and diverse.
How many pieces are in that?
Almost 7,000.
7,000 pieces.
So by far our largest.
Yeah.
But we also have a significant collection of African materials and things from Asia as well.
So do those things, for example, the African things, kind of touch back, you said, your history with anthropological studies. Does that kind of scratch a different itch for you because you're not able to do that as much when you're kind of looking at materials like that balance of, you know, you're a scientist at heart, you know, anthropology is over here. You know, where do those two things intersect for you, the kind of anthropology and fine art, those two things?
That's an interesting question. I came to anthropology in part because of where I grew up. So I grew up outside Washington, D.C., international city, and because of my father's work, he had people from all over the world who would come to work with him for short or long periods of time. So I heard all kinds of different languages and accents and learned about different cultures, even though I grew up in one place for many years. But my father traveled. We got to travel a bit. And so I was always interested in other cultures and how we, as human beings, all do the same things, but we do them in different ways. We all have families, but who do we consider a relative? We all socialize children, but what does that look like? We all have beliefs outside what we can touch and feel and taste and hear. But what does that look like? So I'm interested in how humans get through life, what they think about life after death, and how we create the world around us. So in that way, I'm interested in the African and Asian collections because there are other aspects of how different cultures and different human beings create the world around them.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Benches. When it comes to museum fatigue, the struggle is real. Imagine walking through gallery after gallery without a place to rest and reflect. From cushion to cast iron, from plastic to plus size, they come in a variety of shapes and styles for indoors and out. For more information on Benches, simply pull up your favorite web browser, type in the word bench, and good luck with that. And for a 10% discount on your next bench purchase, you'll probably need to find a slightly damaged one. Remember, don't fret, don't flinch, find a bench.
You've been at Philbrook now for over a decade. What's the job been like in that time? Has it changed a lot? We've taken on new work.
The job has changed radically with the addition of various collections, but specifically the Eugene B. Adkins Collection, which we acquired in 2007. And which we share with the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art at the University of Oklahoma. And that collection, which is large, 3,300 objects, was the catalyst for us expanding into the Downtown Arts District. And so having a satellite facility, having the opportunity to not only renovate, but really create that space as gallery, as collection storage, as library and archive, as office space, and now thinking of it in the future as programming space in all kinds of ways. I never imagined I would have that sort of opportunity when I came here.
Kind of build something from the ground up, basically, like that.
Absolutely. And so the job out of that opportunity to acquire that collection and expand into this new space has meant that the job has changed. But also, as I said, I'm an anthropologist by training. A lot of my professional experience was at the Smithsonian, some at the Museum of the American Indian. But a lot of my time was spent at the National Museum of Natural History with other anthropologists. And it's a very different thing to think about developing exhibitions within a museum of natural history with other anthropologists and other scientists looking at the natural world, as opposed to creating exhibits within the context of a museum of art. And so that's been, I think, a really good challenge for me over the last 11 years.
And so I would imagine when you were in college and studying to kind of do what you're doing now, the world was so different, technologically speaking. I think you were spending a lot of time with your nose in a book or looking at microfiche or whatever. But has the, you know, changing technology impacted the way curators do their work, other than the fact of being able to look up stuff on Google? I mean, is the job different now because of technology, or is it harder, easier? What's changed about it from that angle?
I think everybody's job has changed because of technology, and in a way, it's a lot easier. For instance, databases, having really good pictures and sometimes multiple shots of a piece. So before you go down into collections, into collection storage, you can look up on the computer database and do a search for different keywords, et cetera. But there's nothing like seeing the object in person. And for me, I think that's one of the real strengths of being a curator and one of the interests for me. And I also think it's one of the strengths of museums. Yes, we can do a Google image search and pull up all kinds of images of paintings and pottery and baskets and beadwork. But to see these objects in person is, I think, really exciting and powerful.
So to wrap up, I wanted to ask you a somewhat hypothetical, totally hypothetical, which is, if Vincent Price were here today, let's say the ghost of Vincent Price, it's our Halloween episode, and you get a call that the ghost of Vincent Price wants to take a tour of the museum, and you've got 5 minutes with him, and you can show him a few things from the collection that were not there when he came, what are the two or three things you're definitely going to show Vincent Price's ghost?
Well, the number one thing I would show him is our George Morrison painting, which is on exhibit at Philbrook downtown. It's very abstract. Morrison was an Anishinaabe from Minnesota. Very talented, incredibly prolific, known for his sculptures and his paintings. And I would love to hear Vincent Price's take on our George Morrison piece, Expatriate.
Okay. So we're definitely going to show his ghost, the George Morrison piece. That's a date. Before we wrap up, why don't we go ahead and listen to that piece from The Tonight Show we talked about earlier. I've always wanted to say this, but I think I'll let Jack Nicholson take it from here.
Here's Johnny!
Why is it you feel that people don't understand abstract art? Now, I've been to a lot of the museums, and I see the Jackson Pollock thing hanging in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and it baffles me somewhat. I know he was a trendsetter, and it was new. But I sit there and I look at it, and I'm trying to get some kind of reaction or feeling. Is it all complete? See, if I look at a picture and there's a boy on a pony, that I can understand.
Yeah. What is it?
I know that, but I don't understand. I know it's form and substance and feeling and depth, and you're supposed to receive some kind of an emotional response, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we call the most precious nouns in our language, beauty and truth and honor, these are called abstract nouns because each person has his own definition for them. There is no definition. And abstract art is something that you yourself must define. You can also define it by saying, I hate it.
Right.
But it is very exciting.
They call it the Castle. Built in 1815, it's the flagship of the multi-venue Smithsonian Institution, that most revered of American archives. Named for English chemist James Smithson, born the bastard son of a duke in an undisclosed Paris location in 1765. Smithson's fortune was to have gone to a nephew who died too young to receive it. Instead, it went into the construction of a museum, one that now houses such relics as Archie Bunker's armchair, Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet, and Judy Garland's ruby slippers. Another relic of the Smithsonian is Smithson himself, whose first trip to America was in a coffin, his remains placed in a crypt inside the castle. But there were so many reports of ghosts that in 1973, a curator had Smithson's body disinterred. His casket did reveal skeletal remains, yet the sightings continued. But then again, ghosts in the castle were nothing new. In 1900, 4 years before Smithson's corpse arrived, the Washington Post published a Smithsonian ghost item under the headline, Shades of Scientists Who Walk There Nightly. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
I'm Vincent Price,
and you're invited to my party in the house on Haunted Hill, where so far the ghosts have murdered only 7 people. So won't you come and make it 8? You'll see human heads without bodies. Mysterious pools of blood dripping from the ceiling. The walls move slowly in against you. Don't try to escape, you can't.